What's the weather pattern closest to your heart?
I think I would have to say blizzards. I really loved blizzards as a child. Watching them come down, you could always tell that the best ones, the deepest ones, the longest lasting ones, were going to be the ones with really tiny dry flakes. And I remember watching, you know, them mount up, move higher and higher, and at a certain point, you would be pretty confident that there would be no school the next day. And I remember waking up in the morning and listening to the school cancellation announcements. But it wasn't just about no school. It was just the excitement of seeing this weather phenomenon materialize and transform the landscape. It was really beautiful. I really loved it. So I would have to say that's closest to my heart. And I kind of miss it living out west, that we don't have, or at least where I live, we don't have those kinds of blizzards.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Kai Emmons about her novel, Weather Woman. Together, we'll be tracking weather systems and stormy relationships in the worlds of academia and climate change. Don't go away. On your website, you call yourself a novelist, word lover, people lover, weather and climate obsessed. I want to know your earliest memory of weather and how much of your main character, whose name is Bronwyn, is you.
Well, it is certainly safe to say that I have always been really fascinated by the weather and really excited by it, in a way, obsessed. I think that what I loved about the weather, and extreme weather in particular, was that it created emergencies that made me feel like I could escape from regular life. And I remember, it's particularly the extreme weather that I remember from growing up. The hurricanes where we would go up to our attic and watch the trees swaying. And it was like better entertainment than the movies, really. Then certainly the blizzards that kept us home from school for long periods of time. I remember my senior year in high school, we had a 1-2-foot blizzard and we had a week off of school. Then we had a vacation week. And then we had another blizzard the week that we came back. And that gave us another week off from school. And it was, of course, an adolescent's delight.
What about your main character, Bronwyn? How much of her is you?
I would say there is a lot of her that is me in terms of really the arc of the book. And also, she's a person who has some timidity, timorousness in the context of the academic program that she's pursuing, and she feels bullied by the men in the program. And over the course of the novel, she kind of comes into her own, understands her own strength. And I would say that is most definitely the pattern that I have seen in my own life, is sort of moving towards greater strength and claiming my power and asserting it. And having begun, I remember in third grade, my teacher said that I was very shy. And there's no one in my life that would call me shy now.
I want to get back to the academic realm later, but first I want just to deepen this character of yours. Will you read the beginning of your book?
Yes. This is the what I think of as the prologue, and it begins the section called Discovery. Since she was a child, she had understood the earth's oblique murmurings. Her pores, like the braille-reading fingertips of the blind, easily interpreted messages brought from the air. She had thought nothing of it. It was simply the way she was made. But then, a month after she turned 30, just before the summer solstice, all her senses sharpened, and she and the earth, now co-equals, began to duel and dance. At the time, this appeared to happen without warning, certainly without conscious instructions. But thinking back, she believes she may have hastened the change a year earlier by deciding to move to New Hampshire.
You call Bronwyn earth sentient. What does this mean, and have you known anybody with this quality?
Okay, that's a very good question. I mean that she is highly attuned to all the sensations that greet her body or that her body greets. She is aware of, you know, slight changes in the humidity and in the atmospheric pressure. She's also attuned to wildlife, and she's attuned to the landscape in general. And, you know, when you were asking about my relationship to Bronwyn, mm-hmm. I feel to some degree attuned in that way. I mean, nowhere near to the degree that she is, but I feel very aware. I've always been very aware of changes in the weather, of how the air feels on my skin, mm-hmm. of how it feels to go into the water and have it kind of swirling around. And I love those sensations.
Despite these abilities of Bronwyn's, you also write about her liabilities, which is that she feels like she can't read people as well as she can read the earth. Two of the passages that you write are, why must she struggle so hard to learn how to act in the world? And that she can be a destructive force. She knows this. She feels this.
I'm glad you chose that, zeroed in on that, because I think often when we have a strength in one area, there is a corresponding deficiency in another. And I mean, it's not, I don't think you can necessarily chart it, but there's something about developing a certain power that means that you're taking energy from other things that you might devote energy to. I mean, I think about this a lot in relation to my own life. I have pretty much narrowed the things I do to reading and writing. And, you know, I do yoga and various things. And I'm a parent and a partner. But I'm aware of having a few muscles that I use a lot. And other muscles have kind of, I don't want to say atrophied, but they certainly are not as strong. And I think about this in terms of Bronwyn. She really has, I mean, in as much as she can read the world and the landscape and the air and the weather, she's not that great about understanding other people. Or perhaps she could be, but she's a little bit too afraid to really delve into that realm.
In terms of the plot, Bronwyn leaves academia and one of her primary mentors, Dr. Fenwick, to become a weather woman. And she discovers, again, this great attunement or earth sentient quality, which casts her off into a world of adventure and I don't know, all kinds of things. But at one point, she goes to seek out counsel with one of her meteorological heroes, Vince Carmichael. And the encounter is disappointing for her. And I want to know about your experience with meeting our heroes, because I think it's something most of us have, you know, if we're lucky enough to encounter someone we really admire, and in the moments when they just aren't the person we needed them to be. Do you have an experience like that?
Well, I have two experiences. One is an actual face-to-face encounter. I'm not going to name names, but there was a writer I so admired. And I had the opportunity to meet him at one of the literary arts lectures in Portland. And I was just so, well, I was disappointed in him, but worse, I actually really disliked him. And I thought he was very snarky and very dismissive and really condescending, not just to me, but to other people. And it really bothered me, and I've never been able to read his work since. And I had a similar experience a number of years ago. I had liked Bob Dylan. I mean, who doesn't? But I saw the documentary about him called Don't Look Back. Mm-hmm. And in that documentary, he was really kind of very self-centered, very rude to Joan Baez and all the people in his circle. And it completely changed my attitude towards him. And I couldn't listen to his music in the same way ever again. I haven't been able to. And this was quite a number of years ago that I saw that.
Why do you think it was important to Bronwyn's character and character development to have that encounter with Vince Carmichael?
Well, I think when you revere people too much, it often disempowers you. And Vince Carmichael was somebody she had taken on as a mentor. She'd never met him, but she just thought he was, you know, so skilled at what he did and so earth sentient and so aware of tornadoes. And so she had decided kind of that he was her mentor in much the same way that I might decide a particular writer would be, that I don't know would be. But when she is dissed by him, when she goes and he's downright mean and really humiliates her, she is then able to kind of use her anger and humiliation. And I won't say shame. That's it. She doesn't feel shame. She just feels rage, really. And she turns her rage into something that is really powerful, I think, and beneficial. And then she develops the relationship with Earl, which becomes very meaningful.
And can you just briefly describe Earl?
Yes. Earl is, after she has the dreadful interaction with Vince, Earl is present there, and they happen to run into each other in a coffee shop. And Earl, who is kind of this, he's a minister of some kind, but we don't really know. And he has a small flock of followers or parishioners who come to his house in southern Kansas. And he's just a lover of mankind. That's the way I think of him. And a very, he wears green Converse sneakers, and he's bald, and he sweats a lot, and he's kind of, he's not the kind of person you would necessarily be attracted to on a physical level, but he's so warm, and he so immediately believes in Bronwyn and understands how she has been humiliated by Vince that they very quickly develop a relationship. He actually really worships, well, worship is not the right word, but he certainly respects her capability very deeply and immediately.
Hearing you talk about this clarifies for me that, yes, this book is about a young woman coming into her own power. And one of the other primary relationships of mentoring is with her academic powerhouse, Dr. Diane Fenwick. And what's curious to me about that is, you know, largely the perspective comes through Diane, Dr. Fenwick's, you know, and her expectations of Bronwyn and how Bronwyn has thus disappointed her. So I want to know, you know, why was it important for you to write that version of a relationship, especially in the field of academia?
Well, we will mention that I work in academia, so there's yes. that as a little bit of a background. But also, I think that Diane is to Bronwyn almost a mother. Bronwyn's mother is dead, and Diane, actually even before her mother died, took Bronwyn on and served in a kind of as a surrogate mother to her. And then when Bronwyn's mother died, she became even more central as a mother figure on both sides. I mean, for Diane, because she's never had a child, and for Bronwyn, because now she has no parent. So to some degree, for Bronwyn to defy Diane was what we all go through in adolescence, defying our parents and saying, no, this really is true. I don't care what you say. I can do this, and I don't belong in academia, and I'm leaving. Yes. And then there's the scene where she comes to say, I have to tell you, I can do this thing. You may not believe me, but I really can do it. Of course, Diane is flummoxed by that, and to say disappointed is, she just doesn't know what to do with that. And she already feels cast off by Bronwyn. I honestly feel very sympathetic towards Diane. I loved writing that dynamic because I felt like it was something that's kind of universal. I mean, I don't know any young woman who hasn't had issues with her mother.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Kai Emmons about her novel, Weather Woman. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
In the acknowledgments of your book, you mention a Dr. Box, who's called the Ice Maverick by Rolling Stone, and a real-life weather woman, Candace Campos. Are these your meteorological heroes?
Well, yes. Candace was the first real meteorologist that I spoke to, and she was working in Eugene at the time, where I live. She allowed me to come on the set with her, and she talked a lot about her daily routine and, you know, how she downloads the information and reports it and just the details of her reporting. And I mean, she was so open and so friendly and so eager to share the details of her profession. And she also told me her what had drawn her to meteorology, which was that she had been through Hurricane Andrew in Florida in the, I'm not sure what year that was, but it was a devastating hurricane There was a meteorologist there whose name is on the tip of my tongue. I can't quite remember it, but he was everyone's hero at the time, and that made her decide to become a meteorologist. And then, as for Jason Box, yes, Jason Box is the only person I've ever gotten to know personally through Twitter, which is just a funny thing. Late in the writing, I discovered Jason, and I knew that he was doing this work in Greenland with dark snow. It was called the Dark Snow Project, and he was studying how what happens when soot blows over the Greenland ice sheet and settles there, and then it darkens the snow so that the snow no longer reflects the sunlight, but it absorbs it, and it warms the ice and warms the planet in general. So he was studying this, and I was in conversation with him, and I told him what I was doing with the novel, and he said, well, you should come on this trip to Greenland where I'm going to be the resident scientist. And I decided to go. It just sounded like when you're invited to Greenland, I mean, you have to go. It was really an amazing trip. We went up on the west coast of Greenland above the Arctic Circle, just this ethereal light. And it was June, so it was 24/7 light. Wow. And it had this amazing blue color that made you feel you were really in another world. We went kayaking among these icebergs at one point. And he was there just sort of offering us scientific information and background. And it was terrific. And then since, it turns out his family lives in Oregon. So I've seen him a number of times since. We've become friends.
Kai, there's a clear lyricism, and I might even say a love, when you write the weather lines. You write things like warbling columns of late spring sunlight, tinctures of dawn, sprocketed cumulus clouds. What do you know about how your words are touched by weather?
Very interesting. Let me go back a little bit before I began writing Weather Woman. I was drawn to writing in the first place, largely because of my love for words. It began with words, the sound of words, and the way they feel in your mouth, and the way nonsensical words sometimes, and, you know, nursery rhymes, and all the rhyming of child's poetry. And in my early writing life, I wrote poetry when I was maybe 8 years old or something. That lasted through adolescence, and then I moved to plays, and then fiction, screenwriting, and then fiction. But all along, I think I've been certainly, I returned to fiction because screenwriting and playwriting did not allow for the same extravagance with words, you know? Screenwriting is all about structure, and playwriting is all about dialogue. And while dialogue is great, there are constraints in writing dialogue. I returned to fiction because I loved words and I loved the interiority of fiction. In terms of using weather terminology in this book, I mean, I was very, very aware of wanting to think about weather in an interesting way and describe natural phenomena in an interesting way. So that was kind of always on my mind. You know, there are millions of weather cliches. I mean, I've been thinking about this because I'm drawing up a playlist for Large Hearted Boy. So many songs use weather as a metaphor. I mean, a metaphor for love, a metaphor for relationships of all kinds. It's easy to fall into cliche. Yes. So I guess I was really trying to be aware of not doing that.
At the beginning of the book, you have three epigraphs. There's an epigraph by Richard Feynman, who was an American theoretical physicist. And he writes, "Anyone who's been in a thunderstorm has enjoyed it or been frightened by it, or at least has had some emotion. And in those places in nature where we get an emotion, we find there's generally a corresponding complexity and mystery about it." I want to know why you needed to link emotion and weather.
I think we all have instinctive emotional reactions to weather. You know, the feeling of being alive and excited when we wake up to a sunny day, or maybe a little depressed when it's raining, or for me, you know, on the days of extreme weather, being excited. So I think it's very rare that weather doesn't draw strong emotion from us, whether we acknowledge it or not. And I liked that quote by Feynman because he's a theoretical physicist, and yet he can think about weather in this way that is not just equations. I mean, he can think about it as something that has an emotional valence which I just like so much.
Eileen Pollack blurbs the book and writes, "It's a riveting tug of war between science and intuition." What's your sense then of thinking about Feynman? How do we utilize both science and intuition or emotion in order to address the challenges we face in 21st century climate extremes?
Excellent question. I think one of the things that people don't realize is that intuition plays a role in science. That almost all scientists, or many scientists, let's put it this way, approach what they're doing from some point of having a hunch about something. And the hunch then gives way to an educated hypothesis, and then the hypothesis leads to data gathering and experiment and on and on. We tend to only associate scientists with the data gathering aspect of the process. I was interested in exploring, in giving some validity, should we say, to intuition. Now, as it's posited in the book, there is a tug of war where you have Diane arguing for data and Bronwyn believing in intuition or having come to the point where she operates
yes.
and validates her own intuition after having been very data-driven. Clearly, there's a role for both of these as we go forward. But I think that in terms of the one that has been undervalued, at least by the leaders of our community, I think intuition has been undervalued, and particularly in relation to the Earth and the way we're navigating climate change and the way we're taking custody of the Earth, which is not very well. And I think most of us, we don't need data to know that intuitively. We go to a beach and we see it's junked up with, you know, all sorts of styrofoam and plastics, and we see a gull pecking at the plastics, and we know that this is not good. I guess I'm not arguing for only operating with intuition, but I am arguing that we should all be more attentive to intuition. I think there's so many things, technology for one, a big one, which takes us away from validating our senses and validating our gut-level understanding of what's good for us and of what's good for the Earth.
And Bronwyn's hunches manifest as power, really, this amazing power she has. And I couldn't help but wondering, Kai, what did you imagine for us to take away from her ability? You know, what are we supposed to incorporate as like our own sense of
yes.
empowerment?
One thing I think all along is just that question of intuition. I want people to think about their relationship to the Earth. I want people to kind of think, you know, how much do I feel of what's going on around me? How much am I taking in of the natural world? So that's one thing, sort of validating that. But the other thing is, at the end, when she's in Siberia and has the encounter at the end with the Arctic fox, and she has this kind of imagined dialogue, and the Arctic fox says to her, "Where are your people?" This was the moment when Bronwyn finally realizes that she cannot be doing this thing alone, that this effort of healing the Earth has got to be a collaborative effort. I knew early on in the writing that there was no way that I wanted to write a book where this superheroine comes in and saves the day and heals the Earth all on her own. I knew that wasn't going to happen, but it wasn't really until I got near the end that I understood what the other choice was, which was this idea of collaborating, of needing to work together. Now, can that happen? I don't know. You know, how close are we to being able as a nation or what would have to be an entire globe to making some sort of meaningful collaboration happen? I honestly don't know. I'm kind of bleak about it, to tell you the truth.
I have this sense of a call to arms in sitting with you. I also have a sense that you're the artist. You know, you just get to write the story. And we get to imagine the future.
Well, I mean, I do, bleak as I am, I still like to help out 350.org. And, yeah. You know, I'm trying to do what I can in my own way. But it's pretty dire. It's pretty dire.
Kai, you live in Oregon. And I know Oregon's actually had a tough fire season in California. And Montana this year, we've almost been spared, it seems. You write about the forest fires near LA in the book, and I just want to read this little portion. It is mesmerizing in its hunger, its insatiability, its elusiveness. It seems to retreat for a while as if going to sleep. Then it rears up again without apparent provocation. It gallivants through the trees, a siren confident she'll never be punished. Come, come, I will warn you. It takes what it wants on its own terms, oblivious to human needs. And when I read that, I thought, yes. So I'm just so curious, how did you step into the world of fire?
I didn't become aware of the devastating effects of fire until I moved west. I can't ever remember there ever having been a forest fire when I was living back east. I mean, I'm sure there were, but I wasn't aware of them. But when I moved first to Southern California, it became a very real danger. And I remember one, I was living in San Clemente, and there was a forest fire in Laguna Beach. We could see it on the news hopping across roads. And I'd never seen that kind of behavior of fire before, you know, where it was just, it didn't even need to burn anything in its path. It could make that leap. That was the only time I've ever been so close to a fire that we started packing things up. We didn't ever evacuate, but we got very close to it, and we were certainly thinking a lot about it. I gained then a very healthy respect for the danger of fires. Then I moved to Oregon, and in Oregon, every late summer, fires are a real phenomenon, and they have been getting worse and worse and worse. They've been bad this year, but last year in particular in Eugene, the smoke was so bad that the levels were worse than Beijing. I mean, it was that unhealthy. And this year they have been also unhealthy, not quite as bad as last year. When we went on our annual trek to Lopez Island in the San Juans, we did not have a single clear day, and that's very unusual. I mean, usually it's just, as meteorologists say, severe clear there, but it was all hazy from, I think, 500 wildfires in British Columbia. So I wrote this book on the West Coast where I had become supremely aware of wildfires. And for a while I thought, wait a minute, can I write about this? Is this weather?
Right, right.
I really kind of thought, this is off limits. This isn't weather. But then I thought, no, it's an element, a force of the earth. And so it was in my purview.
Yeah. Kai Emmons lives in Eugene, Oregon, where she teaches. She has an MFA from NYU as well as the University of Oregon. She's also the 2003 winner of the Ken Kesey Award for the novel. Look for more information about her and her work, including a compelling video trailer for her book, at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.